I'd like to convene the February 20th, 2018 meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources. We're going to hear this afternoon from ODF&W on their anti-poaching program. We're going to have to be out of here by 1:45, and so I'd like to call them forward. We're in work session for the ODF&W. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Department of Fish and Wildlife is here, as you said, to report on anti-poaching strategies as required by a budget note that was in their budget bill from the 2017 session.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon and welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today and report to you on the work that we've done as required under the budget note, under our budget, which was House Bill 5010. I've got Roger Furman here, my information education director. He is going to be giving the presentation, and Roger actually led our efforts, our internal team, as an internal and an external team, both ODFW staff as well as OSP Fish and Wildlife Division staff and some public participants as well. So I want to turn this over to Roger to give the presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you all might have.
Thanks. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Roger Furman, Information Education Division Administrator, Department of Fish and Wildlife. As Kurt said, this is our report to you. We were directed to come back to you in February this month with a report on a public awareness campaign and other strategies and tactics, including statutory changes that might be implemented in order to combat poaching, and then bring forward some budget recommendations. We provided you a copy of the written report. You should have that, so I'll just try to summarize this. You'd give the high points of what we are suggesting. As Kurt said, we had an internal work group with representatives of our Fish Division, our Wildlife Division, Oregon State Police, Fish and Wildlife, and we kept Oregon Hunters Association and others apprised of our efforts on this because of their involvement in drafting this budget note. One of the first questions we had to ask is just how aware of is the public of poaching, and what are their attitudes about this? There's not a lot of public opinion polling done on this particular issue in the country. There has been more done in Africa, but we did have some information that came up as a result of some survey work that we did in conjunction with the Alternative Funding Task Force in 2016. There were two open-ended questions in which poaching and enforcement issues were raised as concerns, and about 5% of the respondents indicated that this was an issue or a priority for the agency. To put this into comparison, habitat loss and wildlife impacts were the highest rated in all of these categories. So there's a lot of need to educate folks about this issue and develop a campaign to make them aware of it and the impact of poaching. There was higher awareness of this issue and interest and concern about this from active hunters and anglers and rural landowners, and you'll see how that plays out in our strategies a little bit later. The second question that we need to address is, what is the impact of poaching? If we're going to try to make people care about this, we need to make them understand why this is important. Again, there is not a lot of research done on this particular issue at the habitat or the population or herd level on poaching in North America, much more done in Africa. But you'll see some of the highlights of the South Central Oregon Mule Deer study that was done several years ago. This was a six-year study in which about 600 mule deer were collared. Most of those were doe, and you'll see that legal harvest and illegal harvest were just about the same. In other words, poachers and hunters took the same number of deer. Some key takeaways on that, though, in this further analysis was that 80% of those animals that were taken illegally were does, and they were taken in this October to November time period, which can significantly impact the herd and also undermine our efforts and efforts of our partners to restore mule deer in this particular area. Some of you may have seen numbers before they were out this, but this is the latest analysis, and this is a part of a master's thesis that has been submitted for publication. The other question that comes up is just how prevalent is poaching, Here are a couple of indicators that we found is the Oregon Hunters Association operates the Turn-In Poachers Program. They receive court-ordered restitutions for tips that lead to the solution of a or solving of a case. In 2017, they paid out 177, received 177 court-ordered restitutions. That's the most that they have seen in recent years. Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife recently began tracking detection of illegal harvest as a key performance measure. In 2015 and 16, the first couple of years they reported that, were right around 6,000 cases identified. That went up by about 25% in 2017. OSP attributes that to their ability to fill some vacant positions and get more enforcement present in the field so that they were able to detect more cases and really close more of those poaching cases as well. And that plays into the strategies that we identified, which are really focused on detection and deterrence. OSP, according to their assessment, is many of these poaching incidents are crimes of opportunity. Somebody sees the opportunity to take an animal. They don't think they're going to get caught, so they act. And we think that if we can put together some strategies that reinforce each other, increase the number of the reports, increase detection, and strengthen the penalties, that poachers may think twice before they act. At least that's the strategy. And then if we can publicize that information, we can drive that message home, and maybe they'll have a second thought before they engage in illegal activities. I'll spend some time talking about some of the strategies that we identified. One was this increased public awareness. This would be a multi-part effort, would focus on a paid advertising campaign as well as an earned media campaign. Paid advertising because this is really going to require a lot of effort to get this in front of folks. And we would recommend that this get contracted out with a firm to do this. We don't have the expertise and the resources in the agency to really run a campaign of this magnitude and this type. It would require information delivered in multiple platforms with market-tested messages. We've sat around as groups and thought about what would encourage folks to report poaching, what would prevent people from poaching, and some of the work is what you see on the screen is a logo, which really I don't think is going to inspire folks that aren't hunters and anglers or inspire people to report. We really need to come up with some messaging that's going to drive that home and get people to report. The earned media campaign is going to would require a pretty sophisticated effort to reach out and engage many partners in pushing this message, working with traditional reporting reporters, also bloggers and other groups to get this poaching anti-poaching message out. We would really focus on the impacts of poaching and highlight arrests and convictions, and then provide an easy way for people to provide information to law enforcement to follow up. Engaged in many other strategies involving social media, targeted emails, presentations, billboards, etc. Again, this would be a pretty aggressive effort to get this message out. One of the challenges we have on this is that this is a chart from the Pew Research Center. You can see that the public is now very fragmented in how they get their information. Not too many years ago, if you put something on television, you could reach pretty much everybody. That's not the case anymore, as I'm sure all of you realize. But I want to call your attention to the chart at the bottom. When you look and you see, depending on the age and other demographic characteristics, people get their information in many different ways. So this is going to require many different tactics to get this word out in front of people and encourage them to report. So this will require a lot of coordination by the agencies to make this happen. So who are the target audiences? As we indicated earlier, hunters and anglers. Rural residents or landowners seem to be most aware of this issue, so it makes sense to approach them first. They're folks that have an interest, and particularly landowners have a vested interest in preventing this. They are the ones that will suffer trespass or results because of trespass, litter, and other impacts. They're also in the area and likely to be able to report if we can get them the information on how to report and where to report and what they should be reporting on. After that, as resources become available, we could expand this into other audiences, including the conservation community, certainly interested in stopping poaching and illegal harvest of wildlife, other outdoor enthusiasts, including campers, bikers, boaters, and others. And then after that, you get into the just broad general public campaign. But as you move down this list, it becomes increasingly more challenging and increasingly more expensive to reach these audiences. The other strategies that we looked at is increasing detection. This would be trying to get more law enforcement in the field and more tools for law enforcement to use in order to detect more cases and be able to follow up on those incidents as they observe them. And then increase deterrence, trying to provide additional incentives for people to report and make sure that the TIP program, the Turn-In Poachers program, remains solvent. We expect that as more cases are made, there will be more court-ordered restitution, but that may not be the case. There may be more rewards paid out. So we want to make sure that that component remains in effect and remains solvent. And then increased or potentially alternative penalties. And then this last bullet point is consistent penalties to make sure that district attorneys around the state are treating poaching as a high priority and working with those entities to make sure that those cases are followed up on. You asked about potential statute changes. The first bullet point, civil restitution, is one that you have before you have in the legislature this year. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but some of the other changes could be felony penalties for commercialization of wildlife, bringing back mandatory check stations, in this case focused on big game or fish and wildlife violations. Those would also have the benefit of being able to increase the detection of spread of wildlife diseases and other problems that we are challenged to deal with. This next bullet point, this idea of a roving district attorney, is one that may not require a statute change, but we put it on here as a potential statute change just because it needs some research. But the idea behind that is to give have a state-centered office, somebody probably in the Department of Justice, available to work with local district of attorneys to handle some of those complex poaching cases that maybe cross many jurisdictions, multiple states, or help out in cases where they don't have the resources to address poaching violations, just simply because they have other demands on their time. Other legislative fixes could be clarifying the definition of temporary residence or temporary absence for residency requirements. There is some abuse of that occurring. Also continuing or allowing the use of drones for fish and wildlife enforcement. And then increasing penalties for activities that are often associated with poaching, such as use of artificial light. There were a couple of considerations that we came across as we worked on this that we wanted to make you aware of as you deliberate this. This is really going to require a multi-year commitment of resources if we want to have an impact. A one-off effort to try to do a campaign probably will not be enough. It will take a lot of energy to get this in front of folks. It will require a significant amount of coordination, particularly between ODFW and OSP, district attorneys and the judicial system and partners, to keep this message front and center. And that kind of effort will require additional resources. We don't have the staffing available at this point within ODFW and OSP to put that kind of program on the ground right now. We have limitations on how we can fund this. We receive a lot of federal funding through our Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson programs, but that funding cannot be used for enforcement. We reached out to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Federal Aid Program to check on that. That funding cannot be used for enforcement activities, and they indicated that, in their opinion, this was an enforcement activity, so it would not be suitable for funding under that program. We want to make sure that this information is available in multiple languages, and then, again, as I mentioned earlier, sustainable funding for the TIP program. So, as was indicated, we provided you three levels of potential funding. This is the low-end effort, if you will, but the big emphasis on this is the paid advertising campaign, with the first effort put into trying to understand what the public knows about poaching and developing and testing those messages to see if we can encourage people to report poaching. Again, this is market-based. We want to make sure that that's founded on research, not just a couple folks sitting around and saying, we think this might work. This is too important of an issue, and we're talking about investing significant resources, so we want to make sure that it's done right.
Yeah. Excuse me for a second. Senator,
I just have a question. Thank you so much, Chair Frederick. So are these often the same individuals who are doing this, or Do you know if, do you have any sense of that when you find somebody who has been doing the poaching, is it often a repeat offender, or do you know? Or
I would, Chair Witt, I would really refer to OSP on that since they track that, but the indication was that it varies. I mean, there are folks that are involved in multiple cases, or they offend many times and then caught eventually.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Frederick. So, I guess it's OSP. I guess maybe we have to ask them. I don't know. But are they generally people from that area, or coming from other parts of the state or another state? Or maybe someone else can answer. Just put your name on the record, I guess.
I don't know whether you've introduced yourself or not already.
I have, Co-Chair Frederick, but I'll do it again. Thank you. Kurt Melcher, Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I wanted to add to that. I don't think you can make any broad generalizations about these people, because we don't know. I mean, we don't know what we don't know, to give you a Yogi Berra type quote. we know of the people that do repeat offend and are caught, we know about them. But there's a much broader... it's a much broader problem than that. And so I would not be comfortable just making a broad generalization.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, follow up. Thank you, Chair Frederick. No, I don't know. I was just inquiring. I didn't know if you had any information of that. You know, we have learned this or noticed the OSP, maybe saw some patterns, but have you ever attempted doing any kind of public shaming that for the people that have been caught repeatedly, or that they're, you know, that somehow that information is made quite public in order to shame them? Because it seems odd. Anyone I know, everyone I've ever met, I've ever had a conversation with poaching with, who's a real hunter, really does not appreciate this kind of behavior. I mean, this is really looked down upon. And I was just wondering if any kind of public shaming campaign had ever been attempted.
Yeah. I'm Co-Chair Frederick and Senator Taylor. I don't know that it's been an institutional public shaming campaign. There is certainly media coverage, which leads to these individuals being identified publicly, but it's not been a, you know where the agency or the enforcement folks take out a full page ad showing the.
Not implying that, but so I just meant having something public saying that these people have been charged with, or, you know, convicted of this or something. I was just curious.
Yeah.
Co-Chair and Senator Taylor, that would part of the idea of this pay or earned media campaign is exactly doing some of that, which is we see a lot of coverage of when an incident happens, and then the recall is put out for a reward or tips to lead to the arrest or conviction of someone involved in this case. But often that follow-up part doesn't get reported it or as broadly. And one of the things that would be included in some of this, particularly if we develop a website, which would be open and closed cases, where you could call out what was the resolution of a given case. Mm-hmm. And that may be a case where the folks are identified in that. And that strategy has been used somewhat by other states where I looked at basically what every state has available in their poaching information. And the ones that to me seemed like the best and were most complete, they had that kind of closed loop on this, so people knew that what had happened. And again, that part of that reinforces that strategy is if you act illegally, you take an action, you will get caught, you will get punished, and then people will be aware of that, and that cycle can repeat itself. And again, convince people not to take that action.
Thank you.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I have two simple questions. Just could you please tell me again, what is the current penalty for just simple poaching, and what is the current penalty for commercialization sort of poaching?
I have to look at my notes.
Co-Chair Frederick and Senator Drodd, we'll get that information for you, and just don't have the statutory penalties memorized here today.
Yes.
The biggest threat to hunters is to lose their right to have a gun, you know, and I am an A-plus with the NRA, but I really sit really firm on getting rid of poaching. And so I think if that is, I know the commercialization carries, I think, a minimum, I think it could be a felony charge, which would prevent you from bearing arms. The current penalty for poaching, though, I think maybe somehow saying that, you know, you lose your right to hunt for a certain number of years. You know, I mean, it's there are a lot of approaches that you could take so that it really would come home to the bear that, look, if you get caught doing this, you're out of the woods. You know, I mean, you're not hunting. And because ever since I've been here, poaching has been a problem, and some of it's lack of enforcement, but some of it is I think that we need to put some teeth in the laws that we have.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair. Going back to slide number 5, when you were talking about detentions, mm-hmm. or detections, rather, are those apprehensions, or is there a difference between the total number of people that are in, or cases have been apprehended, and that figure of 7,000 something?
Those, my understanding, excuse me, the co-chairs and Representative Lewis, my understanding those are detections and not necessarily closed cases.
Yes, follow up.
Second question would be, are there certain areas of the state where this problem's more prevalent than others, or is it pretty much uniform statewide?
It doesn't happen in Portland.
Downtown. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Representative Lewis, there may be some areas where there's certainly more localized activity, but I think it's pretty uniform. We see big game poaching cases across the state. There's no single area that stands out as being having a much lower rate, I guess you could say.
Okay, thank you,
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple things. One is that when I first started hunting in Oregon, I think it was 18, 17, something like that, and we had check stations everywhere. Mm-hmm. But yet today I see people in the field, biologists, OSP, sheriff's departments, da-da-da-da, going over the same plowed field all the time, checking in the same area. I had a particular case where we had a biologist, game biologist, had a state trooper, and had a game biologist come in and check an elk. Well, couldn't we coordinate that a little bit better and have those people at a check station instead of being out in the brush like that?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Representative Esquivel, certainly we work our best to coordinate amongst staff in the field. The issue of check stations, though, I think until about, I want to say it was about 1990, somewhere in that era, we had check stations. They were mandatory check stations, and I think, and I'd have to dig into the ancient archives, but I believe they were found to be unconstitutional. Therefore, we could not require these people to stop at a check station. I think that's about the same era that there was. I think at that time, if I might, Mr. Co-Chairs, drunk driving.
That's the Oregon Constitution.
Yes, right? Oregon. Yes.
Okay. And it comes back, and so the only one that can change that's the people. Correct? They can change the Constitution?
That would be correct.
Okay, thank you. Then the other thing is we need to co-op our efforts. I've seen boats with sheriff's departments, state police, blah, 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 on the same river at the same time. We need to coordinate that a little bit. How do we do that?
Co-chairs Frederick Witt and Representative Esquivel, certainly, as you're probably familiar, the counties all have marine patrols, or most of the counties have marine patrols. They're doing patrols for basically for boat enforcement work. They're able to do fish and wildlife enforcement work, but that's not their primary focus. So I think, and we could certainly talk to state police, but there is an effort to coordinate those activities when different enforcement agencies are on the water. But certainly at times overlap, I'm sure, does occur.
Yeah, I would suggest that we do that because, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to have someone standing by that can enforce game laws checking boats while somebody else is going by them to check for game violations. So I think we could coordinate that a little better. But thank you very much for your information and go from there. How much percentage of animals do cars hit? You had 20 and 20.
Co-chairs Frederick Witt and co-chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. It's certainly a significant portion, particularly in that Highway 97 corridor.
Right.
We've been working with ODOT there on wildlife crossings to provide safe crossing areas for big game, in particular because they migrate through that, across that highway corridor as they migrate to and from winter range. I believe Roger is looking up, he has the actual statistics here on vehicle strikes versus hunting versus poaching. Roger?
Yeah, co-chair is Representative Esquivel. From that study, 29% of the mortalities were human-caused mortalities, which were vehicular-caused mortalities. Again, many of those were in that October-November timeframe, and a high percentage of those were does, but again, that in part was because that was the most of the animals that were collared were does, and they were moving into different areas through that time frame.
Thank you.
Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you remind us how the level of effectiveness of your decoy programs? They've been going on for a while now, and I don't know if we've
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Helm. Certainly the state police has a decoy program. That is a program where, just by way of background, they will deploy essentially a deer or elk decoy in the field. It's essentially a taxidermy version, and they will deploy it at critical locations and then essentially wait in observation. These are typically placed near roads where there's frequent access and passing vehicles, and then they'll wait. It's highly effective. I'm sure that they could come here and cite for you all the wildlife enforcement decoy WEDS statistics for you, but they're a highly effective means of catching individuals who are intent on doing something illegal.
Co-chairs, I was at a conversation last week with a officer that had been involved in the OSP Fish and Wildlife Enforcement and now on another detail, and he'd indicated that occasionally when they would set those up, they would have people shoot them almost immediately as soon as they were back out of the area. And so they can be very effective in catching folks that are going to do something wrong.
Thank you. Representative Power, did you have something?
I did. Thank
yes,
you. I'd be interested in learning more about how the check program was unconstitutional, because what comes immediately to mind is we have a similar program to stop out-of-state invasive species from coming into the state on boats, including those who require a permit and those that don't require a permit. So we have check stations in place for invasive species management. If that's constitutional, I'm not seeing immediately why such an analogous program would be unconstitutional.
Sure. Got Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Representative Power. It all comes back to the nature of the penalty. And so if you all, and I think Representative Witt and others might recall, a few years back we changed the penalty associated with transporting aquatic invasive species into a civil penalty, which then meant that we could require vessels on trailers transiting through Oregon to stop at the check station. We would have to do something similar with wildlife violations, which seems to be counterproductive to our interest is in increasing the penalty as a deterrent as opposed to lowering the penalty. I'm not a lawyer, but I was involved in the legislative discussions, worked with Representative Jensen on that particular bill that then made way for the mandated check stations.
Thank you. Representative Witt wanted to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to remind everyone that poaching is not limited to game, but also substantial poaching in the fishing realm. Mm-hmm. And having done a ride-along once to bus poachers for sturgeon, I just want to assure everyone that some of these folks are pretty rough outlaws.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Melcher, wasn't it back in the 70s when if you were caught poaching animals that they could confiscate your pickup, your guns? What happened to that? I think that'd be a costly thing for people.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, that is still the case. And that does occur not unilaterally, but that still does occur in Oregon.
We still confiscate.
Absolutely.
I think that's a good weapon for us, our toolbox.
Did you have something?
Okay.
Thank you very much. I have. Are we at the end of your
close?
Okay. I have a question at the end of that.
Okay. So, just to segue into out of Representative Esquivel's comment, part of the last bullet point would be trying to work with district attorneys to make sure they use all of the tools available to them in prosecuting these cases. So that is part of what would be included in this minimal funding level. The next level of funding really ramps up the outreach campaign, expands the enforcement effort by adding additional troopers, and then this imposes or brings in play this roving district attorney again to do more on the prosecution side. Last segment, the high budget ask expands the enforcement campaign, much more additional enforcement, including the special investigation unit, or expanding that program to tackle those complicated cases, and then enhanced aerial patrols. And then at this point, we would also be talking about potentially additional financial incentives for folks to report, and then a grants program that could make money available to tribes and other government agencies and organizations to encourage them to help them take on anti-poaching campaigns or expand their enforcement efforts. That concludes the presentation, and be happy to try to answer any more questions that folks may have.
I had one question about, could you expand a little bit more on the roving district attorney? It seems that's one of the issues that we struggle with. We don't have someone who knows statewide what the situation might be and who can be called upon in terms of to be an expert.
Yeah.
Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, I think, and this was patterned after, I believe, the Oregon Humane Society does something similar with prosecuting certain animal welfare laws in Oregon. And so our thought was, we know that and many district attorneys we work very closely with, and they're very engaged in wildlife-related crimes, and others not so much. They've got big issues on their docket, so to speak. And so we felt that the opportunity to provide this service, if you will, of a roving district attorney that could work in any of the counties to pursue wildlife crimes could have some merit. And Roger, I don't know if you have any other details you want to share, but.
Sure. In as representatives and members of the committee, the state cannot step in without unless it's invited by the county. Right. And so this would be a service that would be available to them to advise or help in terms of prosecuting those cases. The Department of Justice already has somebody that works at a statewide level on this. Again, this may be already available or possible under current law. We just need to do some more research on this. And many of these statutory changes were just simply ideas that had been looked at, but would require much more research and much more drafting before they're really ready to bring forward for the legislative consideration.
Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. One quick question. We passed a roadkill bill. Has that impeded your efforts in this arena in any way?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, Senator Gerard, no, not yet. That bill, the effective date on that bill is January 1 of 2019.
Oh.
So the commission is in the process, or will be in the process this year, of developing rules to implement that that legislation. And so then it will be at some point in the future as to whether we know that there are problems that need to be addressed or not. So thus far, though, the answer is no.
Sounds like it would be, yeah.
Yeah.
Two more things, if you don't mind. I'm trying to find out. I see a number of things listed in terms of your target audiences. That's good. I'm not sure what you're necessarily including in terms of general public, and I wasn't here when you said that. So could you expand a little bit on what you're talking about? I'm particularly concerned about whether we are going, for instance, it seems to me that the stewardship concept behind the faith community would be pretty much involved in this, and whether you're addressing that, the faith community in this as an audience or not.
Co-Chair Frederick, That was not a particular audience that we had identified. In terms of some of the research, the information that we do have right now is that hunters and anglers and rural residents are the most up-to-date or most engaged at this point. That would be the first effort to try to reach those particular audiences and then reach out to the conservation community. Then after that, other outdoor recreationists is the next level. Both of those audiences are very broad and need much more research and identification of what messages will work, what how we would reach them, what might motivate them. These were just simply the audiences that were identified. My intent is, if we receive the go-ahead to do this, is would reach out and put out an RFP for a firm to actually do the research and the analysis on this and develop test messaging. Test that messaging, develop it, the content, test it on different audiences, and then develop a much more detailed marketing plan and budget for this. We worked with what information we had available on other campaigns that have been done, but it really is going to take somebody that the resources to dig in and identify those subsets of the audience and what messages might work. But certainly the faith-based community would be one that could be part of that, as well as other organizations.
Well, it seems to me that the more eyes you have out there in the field, and since we don't have as many hunters as we once did, those outdoor enthusiasts and the community, the conservation community folks who are out there, might be used as a group. And then finally, speaking of, I mean, you mentioned this, how are we presently using drones? And if so, where and to what effect?
To my knowledge, we are not using them.
Co-Chair Frederick, at this point, of course, the department is using drones on some wildlife research and fish research projects. I believe the state police, I want to say that they're perhaps prohibited from using drones on fish and wildlife-related enforcement.
And who's stopping them? Why is that?
I believe there's a statutory prohibition.
Really?
I believe. But I'm speculating here a little bit. I seem to recall that. They got approval to use them for accident reconstruction scenes, but for some reason I think they don't have that authority for fish and wildlife-related cases.
I know we passed something last year regarding not allowing hunters to use drones.
Right.
But I was wondering whether I thought we still allowed an enforcement you folks.
I think for law enforcement purposes, not. It is not.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative Helm.
Mr. Chair, I think the notion of using drones to aid in the enforcement is a good one. I looked into it last session, and I didn't end up bringing the bill forward because of there's some technical legal issues that are not easy to deal with. It needed more work, and so if you're interested and others are interested, I think we could look at it again in the future and then bring the OSP into that and have them explain to us how they could best use that tool. I think that would help us, and maybe we can get around some of those statutory difficulties.
I'd certainly be interested in it. I like the list that you have here of the potential statute changes. And if we can begin to look at some of those, I think that would be very helpful, and certainly for the 2019 session. But thank you. Keep any further research you can do would be very helpful for us, I think. Any other questions? No? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you. Representative Witt, would you move such?
Mr. Chairman, I move acknowledgement of receipt of the department's report.
Representative Witt moves acknowledgement of the receipt of the department's report. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? I think that's all we have for today. Do you have any sense of what we're going to be dealing with on Thursday?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I don't. I think we're in a holding pattern for some potential bills that are being referred to Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you very much. The snowpocalypse has not hit Portland yet, but we've been everyone's worried about every flake that starts to head that way. So.
It has hit my district, Mr. Chairman.
It has hit yours?
They sent the kids home from school about 10 o'clock this morning.
Oh, well, so. they are sending folks home, the students home from school in Portland right now. I know that in Gresham and the like. But
school's already been released.
So safe travels. Thank you very much for being here. I'm going to close the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources for February 20th.
He's almost 17.